to the AI and Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, the show where we spotlight the innovators and leaders who are transforming the future using the power of data and AI. I'm your host, Dean Gaeta, author, podcaster, and founder and CEO of Infogistics and Slingshot. We're living in an exciting era, a time where builders, leaders, and entrepreneurs are using data and AI to fuel unprecedented growth, create groundbreaking products, and drive meaningful transformations in their industry. If you're ready to learn from some of the brightest minds and uncover actionable insight to take your business to the next level, you're in the right place. And if you have a story to share, stick around until the end of the show. We'll tell you how you can become our next guest and inspire leaders around the globe. Welcome to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. Let's dive in. All right. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Excited to have Panos Tsourtzos. You'll have to say it. I hope I got it right.
Perfect.
It's funny, you're Greek, and there's a saying, you know, it's Greek to me. But anyways, really excited to have you here on board. You've got a lot of great experience as a PhD and a teacher, and spent some time in the EU and kind of recommending their policies and outcomes. And you've got a really cool company. I read a lot about it in prepping for this, Learned World. So very interesting. But why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks, Dean. Thanks for having me. As you said, Panos Tsourtzos, I'm Greek. And now I'm the co-founder and CEO of LearnWorld, which is an ed tech startup that I co-founded with my two buddies from the university. We launched LearnWorld in 2014, and we are a platform for creating and selling online courses, whether in a B2B or a B2C capacity. So we are in the ed tech space. Obviously, it's a very hot space now, learning along with AI. And we are helping more than 12,000 customers all around the world to launch and monetize their online courses. And they have made in total more than $1 billion in revenue over all these past years. So it's a very interesting space to be in.
Yeah, that's amazing. So like you went from researcher to scale. And so I'm curious, so you have a PhD in educational technology and so what evidence-based principles from your academia have most directly shaped how you build and lead LearnWorld?
I think it's a great question. First of all, to say that we built, with my two co-founders, we built our very first learning management system when we were in the academia more than 25 years ago. It was 2000. And actually, we built a platform called EduTech, 2000. So it was, one of the very first incarnations of how we were thinking about e-learning. But it was a small product. It wasn't commercial. It was built to be used in the university, so we just put it aside at some point. What we are keeping from this phase, though, is the science-based principles for what we are building. It's not just about creating a commercial product, but making sure that we ground it on the science of learning, the science of instructional design. But we can also bridge that along with the real needs that real users have out in the space. So this is also how we got into this in the first place and how we decided to build a commercial product. We were very dissatisfied with the products that we were seeing out there. The things that we're doing in the academia were so much ahead, but we're also never reaching the hands of actual users out there and actual practitioners. So what we set out to do is to get the principles from the things that we're seeing in the university and some of the more advanced stuff, and try to bring that at the hands of real practitioners out in the market. And I have to say that when we first launched the platform in 2014, some of the things that we have built into the platform were probably a bit too advanced. So, we had to pare it down a bit, and we had to find the right balance. In some cases, we had to put the scientists in the back seat and listen from the customers. What is it that they want? What's the real problem? Not the one that we imagined, as kind of academics. But I think that after these years, we found the right balance of having our platform grounded in real science of learning, how people learn, how people need to be taught, and also giving all the tools that you need for your business today to have an impact on your bottom line. That's also very important, and we cannot afford to forget that. We want, after all, we want to help people to create and sell online courses. This has to happen today. It's not just about the science, but it's about making your business fly.
Yeah, I think that's great that you're not only helping them create this whole learning experience, but you're actually helping them sell and market it. That's great. So you talk about like the science of learning, and like what are kind of 3 to 5 core metrics you obsess over to measure learning impact and like to drive your own product roadmap and team priorities?
I'm trying here to see differently what our customers need to measure, because all our customers, they run their own business, they run their own training programs, their own coaching programs, they have their own needs. So as a platform, we need to help them to achieve their own goals. So we are giving them a full slate of analytics. This is extremely important. Whatever teaching you're doing, you need to be able to measure the outcome of the activities and the outcome. In a traditional classroom, this is easy. You know, you get the feedback, you do it in real time. But when you are teaching in a synchronous way and at scale, when you perhaps have 1,000 or 10,000 students, you know, you cannot just make sense of what is happening out there. So that's why we are bringing in lots of analytics that allow our students to our trainers to analyze how their students and their cohorts progress, how much time they spend, what's the simple stuff, like when there's assessments to check the results of their assessments, where they might be getting stuck so that they can go in and help them out. We help them build surveys and we help them build assessments, some of them AI-powered. That way, we can allow them to set up their own goals and their own metrics to see completion rates, time spent on the activity, the success rates of the different tests, and to communicate that to them so that they can fix and always improve their assessment. So it's, you know, there's not just one metric that does it all, but we have to give in the tools to the trainers to decide and find their own way on what they need to measure. I hope that helps.
Yeah. So it seems that like based on your domain or what you're trying to teach, there's like a lot of different flexibility in how you're managing learning impact. And so you're providing the flexibility in your platform to allow your customers to customize that best for their segment.
Yeah, we have to, because all our customers, you know, it's almost that we discover a new business model every day or a new niche or a new industry. There are people who are teaching continuing professional education courses where things are very measurable and you need to provide X hours of training in a year so that you can renew your license or, you know, to get to reaffirm your accreditation or something like that. There are other professional courses where you need to be assessed on a certain amount, on a certain body of knowledge. In this case, you might have certain questions, a certain amount of questions, multiple choice questions at with varying level of difficulty. In other cases, some of our customers just offer self-improvement courses about a hobby. It could be photography, you know, it could be how to take care of your pet or your spouse or whatever. In which case, you know, assessment, assessing the knowledge and certifying the knowledge is not as important. What is important there is engagement, how much time people spend on learning activities, how they're not just, you know, cruising through the videos, but they spend time, they interact with each other. Perhaps they talk with, within the community and they participate. So not all learning is made equal. The goals of the trainers depend on, you know, what they want to build, what their outcome they're trying to get. So our platform needs to be flexible enough to cater to all these different use cases and to the business models that these people have built on top of their learning.
Yeah, that's great. Nothing simple there. I guess everyone has their own mode. And like you guys, or Learning Worlds, emphasizes like AI assisted creation. Like, what part of the course lifecycle should the AI own? And What should it assist in, and when should it be like human led?
For now, we don't believe that it should own anything. We believe that AI should help the human trainer in their work, to help them create better content, to help them adapt the content to the audience that they have in front of them, help them in some cases provide personalized feedback. Imagine a case where you have 100 students in front of you and they all go in and take a test. How can you provide, in a scalable way, personalized feedback to all of them about the mistakes that they did in their test? It's kind of impossible to do it in a, manually if you're scaling up. But with AI, you can do it right now. So
Yeah.
we see that we are not here to replace the trainer. We're here to enhance the job of the trainer, the output of the trainer, and to empower them. So what we are providing in the platform is a, let's say, a scaffolding AI assistant that can help them to create the best possible version of their online course. We are not here to start, from scratch creating a course with some simple prompting, because this is probably going to be very generic, very, unoriginal, very same with everything that somebody can create on their own. But how can we get the teacher's existing content, their existing experience, their existing assets, their existing direction, and shape that along with some AI in a very productive system that allows them to create lots of content, fast content, and keep adapting to the ever-changing needs of their students. So if in the past they needed 3 or 4 months to create an online course, can we help them now to do it in a couple of weeks? Not in a, not just all at the same level, but even a more in-depth course, something that is more shaped and fitting to the needs of their students. This is how we're trying to do it. We're not trying to replace trainers. We're trying to assist them. And we do believe that in the era of AI, we'll probably need more learning rather than less. This is our human superpower. There is lots of talk out there now about, AI taking away jobs. Some businesses are kind of finding the opportunity, in some cases using AI as a pretext, to do some layoffs. Some people are starting to worry about their jobs. At least, I guess, in some mid-level jobs, people will start to kind of being squeezed out. In our understanding, we humans should invest in learning. We should invest in the things that make us unique. We cannot compete with AIs in rote memorization or in identifying patterns, or I don't know, handling endless amounts of data. But we are learning fast. We are adapting. We can start preparing our metacognitive abilities, learn how to learn, and try to stay ahead of the game. So we believe that in the next couple of years, learning is going to become even more important in the era of AI, and it's a thing that will keep us, at the forefront of changes, and will allow us to adapt to the financial and business realities out there.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I really worry about like kids going to college or studying and learning and just like the atrophy of human capability. So I'm glad you have that point of view because the AI is a great teammate, but yeah, we need humans to partner with the AI. And if humans don't keep up on like critical thinking, learning, structured learning, improvement, yeah, that's not good for society. So I'm glad you have that point of view. Like, do you have a like there's too many sensational headlines. I mean, what's your point of view of all these sensational headlines that are it's really scaring the marketplace? I mean, it's scaring like everybody.
It is scaring. I guess that's also the only objective of these headlines are to be scary. Are they are to be read? They need to be sensationalist, because otherwise nobody will pay attention. And I believe that they're overdoing it. There is a
Yeah.
very real use case for AI, for the value of AI. as I said before, lots of businesses are using that as a pretext, you know, because they might not be going very well. So let's do some layoffs and blame it on the AI. It's a very easy thing to do. But so if they do it, even if they get the short-term productivity gains with AI, if they're not investing in a learning system, in a system that will allow their people to grow along with the growing problems and issues that the company faces, if they don't have a system to bring in the young guys, you know, the rookies that will come in and start learning and becoming the future rock stars of tomorrow, how is this organization going to survive? So it's very easy, and in some cases we see that also internally as an organization, and we also see that in learning.
That's a huge point. Huge point. More CEOs need to hear what you just said, because if you're not developing your people and that pipeline to be the next, you know, executives and senior contributors, you know, we're all in trouble downstream. So, and episodically, like, it's having some of that effect because of these sensational headlines. And I just, more people need to hear what you just said.
And I think, you know, there is, we also see that on the learning side of things, how AI can kind of create, hide, I guess, the problems of a learning, the underlying problems of an online course. But also we see that on the business side, because AI is very eloquent. You know, it creates some perfect text. It creates an illusion of perfection there. You're asking me something and you get a very well, you know, placed and presented answer. But in so many cases, it's so superficial. It's so, you know, it has some false confidence. It induces passivity, because you see it, it says, okay, it looks right, I can send it to my colleague. And then you discover that, you know, the substance wasn't there. It had some illusions. It created a few things out of thin air. So we need to up our, to be more alert about what we are reading. Even though it's very well expressed, it might still be something that doesn't make any kind of sense. And we see that in the online courses that some people go out and create, if they don't use the right direction and the right instructional design framework to create an online course, it's something that when you look at it on the face value seems great, but once you start reading, you say, doesn't feel good. Like it's missing the substance. It's missing the narrative. It's missing the conflict. It's missing what a good human professor would use to, you know, to create interest and create engagement and create passion and anything else with a student. And also we see that sometimes internally when we're working with our teams, where somebody creates a very well, you know, a great presentation, great looking presentation with some AI. It sends it to the colleague, to their colleague. Then their colleague uses some AI to, you know, to create some critique on the presentation. And you have the different AIs talking between them instead of the two people arguing. And this is what we want. We want the people to understand, argue, fight, use AI, obviously, to, you know, to get to their point faster, to be able to support what they're doing. But it's very, very easy to just, you know, get some kind of cognitive passivity and start relying on the AI. We need to be working with AIs, but we need to be guiding them, not to be, you know, slipping on the, like, again, it's like, would we trust, how do we trust, how much do we trust a self-driving car? I would like to be able to, you know, to keep the control if I have my family with me. That's how I feel right now with the current level of AIs and with how much we should be investing in our teams, helping people how to learn with AI. It's going to be there. We are not against that, but use judgment, question the results, synthesize the results of humans and AIs and create this strategic level understanding of how AI is just another tool. It's not here to, we cannot allow it to replace us.
Yeah, and another critical point. I mean, I've even observed in our own organization where, the working with AI, come up with some strategy, and then you start to get like cognitive overload because it's like too much. Like a human would have broken it down a little bit more simpler to communicate, to collaborate around. So then you have this huge document, and then people are like, okay, AI, summarize that, give me a counterpoint. And it's like what you said is like, no, that's just like the human being a workflow instead of critical thinking. And so I couldn't agree with you more. Like, yes, use AI, get some good strategy, good solutions, but then, distill it with your thoughts and then collaborate with the team. But yeah, can't get caught in that loop. And what your company's doing is critical, which is continuing to improve human capability. I mean, that is just so important. I worry about that every day. And I'm, anyways, I just wanted to share that with you. I really like what you just said. So your platform like serves really large scale learners and customers. So how do you guys design in a data feedback loop that can improve outcomes, without just kind of vanity metrics or shallow engagement metrics, or like how do you guys do that?
How do we design the features of the platform and
Or not the features, but like how are you helping your customers with kind of data feedback loop through your platform to help them increase engagement and better outcomes, better content, better learning,
I think part of it is learning from our customers and improving the platform, bringing in a new affordances and new features and new things that can help them. So we are right now across our 12,000 customers and more, there are more than 32 million learners. So that's something that we're trying to learn from all of them. We're trying to analyze these signals in an anonymized way and trying to see what is working and what is not working. What type of content creates the best engagement? What can we learn from there? And we're trying to, to derive these patterns and these insights and share them through content that we produce ourselves, through webinars, through seminars that we are doing, to help our customers become even more successful. And we tell them this is what works. This is what works for marketing. And also, this is what works for the instructional design. This is the types of courses or the types of learning units that work best. Let's try to use some of those. Let's see what other successful school owners did out there so that you can emulate some of their success and you can follow their steps. And also, we continue to research to see what's the state of the art around e-learning and also what works from a product point of view. And we are bringing these as features to help our customers become more successful. So we brought in AI with a framework that we are guiding, not again, not to replace them, but to help them be more productive. So let's say one of the most boring things that a trainer or a professor or a teacher have to do is create multiple choice questions for tests. You have to go in and then you have let's say, a couple of chapters and you need to test that in a quick way. And then you need to create 100 multiple choice questions and that will take you 3 or 4 days and it can be very boring. But with some AI assistant on the side, we can ask our AI based on the presentation or the ebook or the PDF that we'll upload to create for us 100 multiple choice questions of varying difficulty based on the Bloom taxonomy, which means that it targets different kinds of skills of users. And you can have that in 3 minutes. So this is where we can help the teacher instead of, spending time to create a slope or to create something that can be boring. To take this burden away from them so they can focus on what they can do best. Creativity, ingenuity, connecting with the students, incentivizing and getting their students along with them. So we are learning both from their best practices and also what's the state of the art of AI, and we try to implement that within the platform and to share what we're learning. So that everybody can create their best possible online school and be successful.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great vantage point you have to learn from all that data and share it with your customers to improve. Yeah, that's fantastic. So I'm interested, like your background has some interest in privacy and ethics, and you worked at the European Parliament as a research innovation policy advisor. And so what did that experience, how does that change your thinking about product strategy with AI governance, privacy, trust? Like what, like, because you come from an interesting perspective. I'm curious how that's guiding your own thoughts
I
about
think,
product.
yeah, very interesting question. I guess it's probably my background, and also along with my co-founders, starting from the academia, it's probably not the most straightforward path to entrepreneurship and to launching a business, and creating a big startup and scale up and stuff like that. But for me, this has been very formative experiences, especially when it comes, and these questions are becoming even more important now in the era of AI, privacy and ethics, computer ethics. When I'm building software, what kind of software am I building it for? And what do I allow it to do? And will it harm humanity? Not immediately, but in the long term, if I'm not careful enough. So for us, for me, this has been extremely formative experiences. You obviously know that Europeans have also this more sensitive vantage point when it comes to privacy and data, it's which is kind of slower when you are launching a startup, but we believe that in the long term it might be more beneficial. Now humanity is running, towards the AI, more AI, and I don't think that all companies are always stopping enough to think about what they're doing. They're doing it because they can. They're doing it because they think that they must. They are doing it because the numbers and the investments that they have gotten mandate them to create these kinds of huge results and go out and replace everyone in the world with some kind of AI. Otherwise, all these investments probably don't make sense, the investments in some of these, the LLMs and in some of these data centers. But I'm not sure, we're probably caught in a loop and we should be stepping outside and seeing what we're trying to do. Sitting closer to people and humans and students gives us, I guess, the obligation to be much more careful about what we're trying to do. So obviously we have to do that in the business environment. We're not just playing alone out there and testing things. We have to do that in a way that also makes sense for our customers and helps them help their own customers. For us, it's great that we are working with humans who are working with humans. Our customers are respectful of their own customers. They're trying to help them. It's not something that where they're just trying to maximize the financial output without thinking about the humans. It's part of what we do. Part of what we do is helping our customers, helping their human customers. So I hope that we are making, I'm using this experience and this sensitivity, I guess, that we have about the human condition and the privacy and our obligation towards all this data that we're gathering and all towards all this time that people are putting into learning a new thing to create the best possible experience for them and respect them and help them to navigate the changes that are coming along for all of us. And I really believe that in the next few years, learning is going to become even more important, and we need to be there to help people get these skills, get retrained, reskilled, retooled for a future that is coming too fast, I guess, for some of us.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good value-based point of view, but like, how do you do it practically? Because I mean, the LLMs have memory, they remember, they have context. I mean, you can anonymize things, but like, are you guys, like, how are you guys dealing with that? Like, that
Well,
privacy and, yeah.
right now we are also using commercial LLMs, but also we have the agreements in place to that allow us, you know, to send them data that are not used for training the LLMs, so the interactions are kind of memoryless. Yes, we provide the context. So for just to give you an example, every one of our schools is isolated, so the data is only held within the school, and whenever we use some LLM calls, we provide a certain level of context, which is then not it's forgotten then by the LLM. So these are some simple things that everyone is trying to do. Also, we are trying not to be that's something that we're working on right now, not to be tied to one single LLM, so that people can have choice, so they can bring in their own LLM of choice, and they can make sure that their data are protected and respected. That's, I guess, we're also following, we're trying to follow best practices here, and we're trying to see, to make sure that nothing goes out, the data are self-contained, whatever we're using internally in terms of analyzing and learning from our users is always anonymized, and we use pre-processing to scrape away all the private and sensitive data from there. I think these are things that hopefully most businesses are doing, and you know, they're going to be even more critical down the line, because these things, they're learning fast, and AIs now are almost in every tool that we're using. In some cases, we don't even realize it, but every software that somebody's using now, you know, some AI pops in, and you never know how it's treating the data. So it's becoming more of a question, a more urgent question.
So I'm kind of curious. I mean, there's been some, like, just recent events just in the last couple of weeks where Anthropic Claude is not allowed to be used now by the U.S. Department of War. And then, you know, OpenAI stepped in to take advantage of that kind of business opportunity. But I don't know if people realize, I'm curious of your point of view, that so it has, like I use all of them as well every day. And so, like, ChatGPT, Claude, they remember everything I'm doing. They know what kind of company we are. They know what I'm working on. They know personal things about me. So they have this amazing memory and profile of me as personally and professionally. And I mean, what perfect surveillance tool than to have a major LLM to do surveillance? It's kind of scary. I mean, it's scary from a government point of view, or I mean a citizen point of view, and it's scary even from being marketed to. They know so much. And then the other problem is they're so useful that you want to just keep giving it more and more data, asking it more and more questions. And so it's almost like, even though I'm a tech person, I know what I'm doing, but like the lure of like productivity is there. Like it's a little bit crazy what's happening. I mean, what's your point of view there?
It is crazy. It's exactly as you said it, because the lure of productivity is huge. Like, the more you give it, the more personal and helpful it can become. But on the other end, it's a black box. So, you know, you might pop up in a terrorist database, and you might not even have an idea why, you know, and not if it's AI process, because AIs are, the LLMs are just statistical tools right now. They are highly, obviously, sophisticated auto-completion engines. Of course, they've read everything that humanity has ever written or said, or close to that, you know. And, you know, in some cases, these LLMs now create artificial data in order to train their next versions, because they have already consumed everything that it has ever been written. So they are, I'm kind of oversimplifying, but by saying that they are autocomplete machines, but that's their premise. That's how they work. Even when it comes to recollection, I think there was a very great metaphor that they are like JPEGs of the entire web, which means that if you start zooming, you will not find the accurate information. You will find some approximation or some kind of average, some kind of statistical analysis, which means that they are being supported by RAGs and databases, and they can be very accurate, but they also have limits. So in some cases, you double-click and you go in and you double-click, and then you find something that is really made up or something that, you know, it's not, it never read. It just recreated something in order to satisfy you. So on their own, they're very, very scary because they cannot be always reproducible. They cannot be always accurate. Which means that they have, you know, they're black boxes that we need to find ways to scrutinize, and we need to understand why they are suggesting some certain course of action, whether it's why they're suggesting to a doctor that is using some AI on the side a certain procedure that, you know, we need to understand that the person who is getting the suggestion understands the state, understands what the suggestion is about, and it's not just somebody who just pushes paper or moves things from one side to another. So if, you know, the Department of War or whatever public service is using these things, I really, really hope that the people who are in place understand, you know, the stake of a suggestion that might say, okay, Dean is not one of the good guys, so, you know, let's go out, let's go and take him out. Why? You know, where's the answer? And who can make sure that the answer is there? There are frameworks. Scientists have produced frameworks to work for, you know, along these of kinds of very difficult questions. And even politicians have worked in the past. In the European Union, when I was there in the European Parliament, we were working about the you know, GDPR, which is the data protection regulation, which is a dreadful bureaucratic thing when you are a small business and you are trying to navigate all this complexity. But on the other end, it created a huge safe space in Europe and a different kind of discussion around the protection of data that is especially necessary when you think that in the light of the coming AIs and what they know about us and what they want to know. We were discussing about the right to be forgotten. You know, a 12-year-old might go out, do a stupid thing on the web, and the internet will remember it for the another 90 years of its life, and you will never be able to get rid of that. So in the era of AI, these questions become even more meaningful. I don't have the answers, but scientists and politicians who have worked with these subjects, they do have frameworks, and, you know, that's a discussion that we're not making enough of. We are discussing about this, the next funding round of the big LLMs, when they will go into the, you know, when they will have an IPO, whether Department of War will use a model X or model Y, and we're not asking why or how it should use it. You know, it's kind of things are going too fast, and we are not thinking enough about this.
I couldn't agree with you more. So let me change in subjects a little bit. So you run a distributed team across Europe, and maybe you can share some of your operating cadences, maybe your OKRs, rituals, rhythm of the business, that, you know, has kept your execution really tight, that, you know, you can share with others.
Yes. First of all, as you said, we are a distributed team. We were a distributed team since the beginning, because that's for practical reasons. When we started as co-founders, we lived in two different countries, three different cities. So it wasn't an option to go into an office and work together. We had started young families back then. And the only thing we could do was work online with the current of tools that, if we look at them now, they were kind of primitive. You know, it was before Slack, it was before Zoom, it was, we were using Skype back then, you know, to do our calls. But we created also, as we started to get in more and more people, this became our strength. We were distributed, we were getting people, smart people and willing and capable people wherever we could find them. We weren't, isolated or restricted to a single market. We had to over-communicate because obviously there are things that you miss if you don't work in the next desk with somebody where you can, you know, in a matter of minutes, you can solve huge problems. So we had to over-communicate. We had to create these rituals, as you say. We had to be online in a channel, say good morning, you know, share a couple of jokes, start working together, even if we were working in, 500 miles away from each other. We persisted with this. At some point, I remember it was early 2018, we were discussing with some potential investors. It was before we did our first seed round. And they were kind of telling us, guys, you are uninvestable because you don't have an office. When are you going to get serious about doing a business, you know, go into an office? And we said, that's not us. We're like, we can't do it. That's our reality. We continue building the business, but, you know, we don't believe in an office. When COVID came along, it suddenly was the reality. It was the new thing for us. We had zero switching costs. We were already a remote company. At that point, in the very early days of COVID, we were growing by triple digits annually. So, we were just adding more people wherever we could find them. You know, it didn't matter. We just shipped them a laptop. They got into their own systems, and we kept working together. So, over-communicating, lots of management, lots of layers of not reporting, but getting in touch with people so everybody has their team or everybody has their tribe. They have their daily ritual. They have their systems for recording the progress of work. We are very flexible as a team. We never count hours. We count outcomes, you know, that people really showed up when they had to. They helped their colleagues and their teams and their projects get along, and they just, did the things that they were supposed to do. That's, for us, extremely important. And it's also what people want when they have to run a life. They have to, to run a family at the side. So they really value this flexibility. And trying to stay close to people, even remotely. Open doors, open Zoom, open Slack policy. Everybody can, come to us and talk to us at every point. And as the founders, and me and my co-founders, we're trying to be very close to every level of the business. You cannot manage people, from 30,000 feet, trying, become as the CEO. I really believe that I need to know what the job, at least the qualities and the substance of the job that everybody's doing, so that I can empower them. I can bring in the resources that they need. I can try to find the training that they need. I can try to hire people.
I mean, you have a couple hundred people or more, and how could you know that? Like, what kind of, how do you do that?
First of all, I have great co-founders as well, so I cannot do that for the entire business. My co-founders are doing that for the CTO is doing that for the product side, or the development and the execution. My other co-founder does that for the product design and the scientific part also of the business and the design and the product design. So we distribute. We always try to go into the different. When there's a big project coming along, where there's a new feature or kind of a re-architecture or a new marketing project, we always try to have at least a couple of people from us to understand. Lots of one-on-one meetings, lots of skip-level meetings, lots of reading, lots of AI on the side, to help me understand what is happening. And I cannot say that I can be the individual contributor, but I really need to understand what they're doing, what are their challenges, what's the next thing that they have to solve for, so that they can bring them the help. So I can definitely not replace all the people, but I need to understand enough of what they're doing to understand what's at stake, what's their challenges, so that I can keep helping them and keep hiring people that are, much smarter than me, more experienced in the next stage of the business, what we're trying to solve for, and bring these people on board.
And what's your process or thinking, right, to approve new headcount, which is always hard? Like, it's always hard to to do that. I mean, what could you share, others could learn from, in terms of how you make those decisions? And then, a second question is, what are the 1 to 3 things that you do, in a rhythm base, once a month? I talk to everyone on it. What could you share that really works for you in running a distributed organization?
First of all, when it comes to headcount, we are also trying to AI now definitely gives productivity. So now we're thinking twice whenever we have a new role. There was a phase in Learnworlds when we were above 100 people, growing very, very fast, and when we had a problem that we wanted to solve, we were thinking about a person to hire. So we do have a problem here. Let's bring in the manager of fix, and that started adding lots of headcount. And then when you started solving the problem, the person was not always relevant, and we had to find something else. So now we're trying, obviously, with AI, we are much more careful about hiring, how we can create productivity, how we can take away, the basic needless tasks and how we can automate them so that we can have people guide teams and how we can help them guide the AIs and guide agents to do the work. So we have set ourselves a mental limit of about 200 people, where we believe that that's a size of the organization that can keep growing, and we can probably double in output by increasing our productivity without having to add more people than that. And we obviously take care also. We try to see how other organizations at our size and bigger size are doing that. We are in the happy position to be an inside portfolio company. So there is huge. They are one of the top private equity firms in the US. They've invested in more than 300 currently through more than 300 software businesses. So we learn a lot from that space. So we can see, is this right sized? Can we do that more efficiently? How are others doing that, without adding too much headcount? And definitely headcount is needed, but let's put it on the right spots where it can really bring results and it can really, have an impact. So if somebody like on the product side, it's always a huge investment. We always hire. We have now multiple positions open. There is huge need to keep building more product faster and bring more solutions to our customers. But in other places, at admin, let's say, G&A, you don't need too many people now to automate things and have a very efficient organization. So that's, I guess, one way of solving that. And coming to the second aspect of your question, there are some rituals. I'm always trying to have at least, one monthly one-on-one with the various team leads in Learnworlds, especially on the marketing and GTM and customer success side. I also try to have at least a monthly skip level meeting with people that are working within those leads, at least in some of the more, I cannot do it with everyone, but in the more urgent projects, let's say, of every quarter. These are for me very, very important because that's how I understand what's the sentiment in the business. What's not just from the reporting, not just second level, but trying to have first-hand information about what is happening. Also, weekly meetings with some of the team leaders, especially around the growth of the business. This is our growth council, where on a weekly basis we have to go in, we check the numbers, we make sure that we have a common understanding. And if we see something that we don't understand, let's, make sure that we speak the same language and we have the same understanding about the problem, and then see how we solve it. We're trying to do at least bi-monthly, like once every couple of months, but we're trying to do that earlier now. Our all hands meeting, where we're very transparent about the data as an organization. Everybody knows what's our growth, how much we are earning, what's the competition doing. So we always try to share this and also share what are our problems, like what's urgent for us to work on that particular month. So we're trying to have this transparency and this sense that we're all together in it, and we'll have to go out and do our work.
Yeah, that's smart. Great advice. Thank you for sharing that. So you've been involved in this learning for so long. Where do you see agentic AI and this whole customer education learning? Where do you see it going over the next 12 months?
All of it is, I think it's relevant. And I'm saying that because as a platform, we do lots of different things, and there are people who are using the who are using LearnWorlds as a platform for internal training, for external training, for customer education, and for selling courses, distributing courses either in a B2C or a B2B capacity. We do believe that there is the most urgent need in the next couple of years is for B2B training, like businesses who really need to train and retrain their employees, but they cannot just get some off-the-shelf material that is already stale, you know, the date has been published. They will probably will have to work with the experts, whether it's AI experts for teaching, you know, AI skills to the to their employees, whether they are compliance experts, whether they are, you know, coaches and business coaches or whatever. So we really do see an acceleration in this in this space. And again, we are working with businesses of all size, but we do see a huge need in the SMEs and mid-market businesses, who are the ones who do have a certain capacity. They do have, you know, there is a team there. They do have the budgets, but they can't afford to wait. They need to keep moving really, really fast, and they need a learning engine and a learning system, a learning operating system to help them accelerate as businesses and not become irrelevant in the era of AI. So we do believe that there we do have a huge role to play as a platform.
Yeah, all right, couldn't agree more. And that was there a question I didn't ask you that you wish I'd have asked?
I think I really enjoyed our questions, Dean. Something for me, it's kind of a bit self-serving because we talked a lot about learning. If anyone from your audience has interest or has a project that they would like to solve, just come to our website and talk to us. You know, there our platform is there to use. Our use cases are there. E-learning is a vast thing, so I cannot even begin to comprehend what kind of projects your audience here is having. But we are in the learning business, and I do believe that we have a solution for everyone. So come to talk to us, and we'll be super happy to take on your project, discuss with your team, and see if we can help you.
Excellent. And how can people get in touch with you?
They can always find me on LinkedIn, Panos Hiosos, my name. They can just reach out and connect. It's safer there than the emails that usually get lost. And again, happy to see you on our website. We do host regular webinars with my team, talking about e-learning, talking about AI, especially offering accelerators and support to keep to people to help them create their first even online course. So if you come to our website, you'll probably find something very relevant, and you'll probably meet me there, one of our webinars.
Great. Thank you so much, Panos. I appreciate the conversation and all your experience and insight. Very, very valuable and very well grounded. Like, everyone needs to keep learning, please. And I love it. AI is not going to take over to everybody. But thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you, Panos.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Dean. Have a nice day.
Hey, it's Dean Guida here. Thank you so much for tuning in to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast, where we showcase the visionaries who are shaping the future with data and AI. If you're a successful leader, entrepreneur, or business professional and want to share your story on this program, we'd love to hear from you. Visit us at podcast.slingshotapp.io to apply. Got something value out of this interview? Share the love. Take a quick screenshot, post it to your favorite social platform, or text it to a friend. Don't forget to tag the show and use the hashtag AI Data Driven Leadership. I love seeing your posts and suggestions for future guests. And if you know someone who would make a great guest, let them know about the show. We're dropping new episodes regularly, so don't miss out. Hit subscribe wherever you listen, and if you enjoyed this episode, a quick thumbs up, rating, or review would mean the world to me and my team. Want to stay connected? Visit our website at podcast.slingshotapp.io or find me on LinkedIn at Dean Guida and Instagram at DeanGuida89. Thanks again for listening to the AI Data-Driven Leadership Podcast. We'll see you next time.